pardon the interruption, but I'm Mike Wilbon. Tony, more than 30 people in Stephenville, Texas say they saw a UFO. You believe them?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Tony Kornheiser, believe him. Who do you think was up there getting probed?
I thought it was interesting because I read Firestorm, the Andruffel book about James McDonald, which is outstanding also. You guys, the two books together are like, I'm dying to go back and read that one now that I've read your book. I read Firestorm a long time ago, so it's, you know, I'd like to do a refresher myself on it now because it's very similar. So did he, aside from when, and you can tell this story, but aside from when McDonald's stormed into his office and reamed him out, did he have any other interaction with McDonald? Because to me it was like, you said that, you know, McDonald left the office and he was kind of like, oh, thank God there's somebody else who's looking at this. Mm-hmm. But then he never shows up again in the book. What was the relationship between those two like? Because you would think that they'd be a dynamic, and I know McDonald probably passed away a few years after that, I'm willing to bet.
Yeah.
I don't think they had much time to interact, but you would think that those two would have been a super tandem to work together on this kind of stuff.
I know. Talk about lost opportunities. You're right. They would have been an incredible dynamic duo. But to answer your question, I if I came across anything at all in Hynek's records involving Dr. McDonald, there wasn't anything I recall seeing that was really very noteworthy.
Yeah.
As I mentioned before with Carl Sagan, Dr. Hynek maintained, you know, very cordial professional relations with a lot of fellow scientists, you know, because there was always a lot of exchanging of ideas going on. There was always a lot of, you know, hey, I'd like to do this project. I'm wondering if you or your school would be interested in working with us on this. There was always a lot of correspondence between Hynek and other scientists. And I have a feeling that I did see some here and there between him and Dr. McDonald, but nothing that really stands out in my memory is very significant.
Yeah. All right. Interesting. Now, do you think, here's a sort of another kind of ponderous question in a sense. You know, we talk about the MJ-12. It's like, oh, the secret government group of scientists and stuff. We kind of know from your book about the Invisible College, which is kind of like the antithesis in a sense, like a secret, an underground group of academics and scientists who are looking at this stuff, who were looking at this. I guess the question is, do you think that's carried on, or do you think sort of like the people looking at it have gone their separate ways? Like, do you think there's this sort of collegiality between academics who are looking at this, or they not even tell each other that they're doing it?
My sense is that there's really not a whole lot going on, and I hate to say it; it's kind of heartbreaking.
Oh yeah, no, I mean that's
it doesn't seem right, but at the same time, you know, there are still plenty of people out there who are interested, and you could even say probably vitally interested in the topic. You know, so there probably are pockets here and there where there are people, you know, doing at least some casual research, but as far as any like force to be reckoned with, no, there's really not. As I mentioned, Dr. Hynek's Center for UFO Studies—it's not even a physical space anymore. It's just relegated to, you know, a bunch of file cabinets and bookshelves in a couple of basements in Chicago, and you know, there's not much else out there. I mean, we all know MUFON is this huge organization that
yeah.
is in, you know, heavily involved in all aspects of the UFO phenomenon, but. As much as MUFON likes to say we're scientific, they're not really scientific. So
no, they have a lot of problems at the moment. I
yeah.
don't know if you're
I left MUFON recently for good reason. So,
I think we're on the same page then. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we are. And I had several reasons for leaving, but no regrets there.
Yeah.
But at any rate, as far as you know, scientific. But here's the interesting – I don't see anything going on with UFOs, but I also want to say, though, in the scientific community, what's getting so much attention these days is the search for exoplanets.
Yeah.
And the search for habitable planets around distant – well, not distant, around nearby stars, the ones we can see, that may be capable of supporting life similar to ours. So if you think about it, science actually is sort of looking in the same direction as the UFO phenomenon. They're looking at something different, but they're looking in the same direction, I think. So to me, I kind of take that as encouragement and comfort, like something is being done. People are paying attention to this idea, to this concept. You know, they're using different words and they're using different terms, and none of these exoplanet scientists would ever talk about UFOs. But as I said, they're kind of looking in the same direction anyway. They're looking at the possibility that something else exists that we don't know and don't understand yet. And think about the explosion in that, just that one field. It wasn't that long ago that most scientists would have told you the chances of life developing on other planets is exceedingly rare. But now all of a sudden in the last few years, we've just had this explosion of information about these other planets. And all of a sudden we're looking at, whoa, there are actually a whole lot of planets out there that could be capable of supporting. That's a huge paradigm change, and it's just happened within the last couple of years. And it's not just happened among scientists. We're all going along with it, right?
Absolutely.
We all are like hanging on that news and being like, oh, my God, maybe this is the planet. Maybe this is the one. Maybe it's Europa, you know? So I've been following that whole thing really, really closely and with a lot of excitement because, you know, I think maybe this is the next phase of what we're looking at. Maybe this is the next phase of studying this phenomenon. I don't know. I'm kind of speculating wildly here, which I'm prone to do. But it really excites me because I think that's the closest thing we have right now to that golden age of UFOs.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and I haven't heard it put that way, but you're right in a sense, because like they're looking for the aliens essentially.
Yeah,
folks. I mean,
they literally are.
Yeah, they're looking for aliens, even if it's an amoeba on Europa. That's what they're looking for.
Yes, exactly.
You know, so it's
because that's one thing leads to another.
Yeah, for sure.
You just don't know.
And to throw a dig in at our friend Carl Sagan. For everyone lauds him as he say, oh, billions and billions of stars. No, man, there's trillions and trillions of stars. You were wrong about that.
Yeah,
Carl
and why
Sagan.
Were you wrong? How could you be so wrong?
Yeah.
Come on.
No one called you a visionary, but it turns out you were wrong. So maybe if he was here, he'd give a second look at the UFOs, but I have doubts about that. But, yeah, it's interesting nowadays because the UFO field, it's, like I said, after Hynek went, I love Stan. I think Stan's the man, Stan Friedman. He's like a personal hero of mine. He's sort of carried on the torch as the public face of UFOs. But as he gets older, to me, it's like, I don't know where this thing's going to go from here, man, because I don't have much faith in, you know, the future of, I guess, sort of this subculture, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've thought about that, too, and that topic has come up in some of the interviews I've done over the last couple of months. And I think there is still some power behind it. And I think podcasts and shows like yours are proof of that. You know, we've got people like you who are keeping the conversation open and keeping the conversation interesting, and you know, and making sure it doesn't get stuck on some useless dead end. You know, as long as we've got guys like you and everyone else out there doing their UFO and paranormal podcasts, letting people like me, you know, talk about our ideas about the phenomenon, you know, I think there's a lot of hope that that UFO research will, you know, find a new way and, you know, find a new format, a new vehicle. I don't know how you want to describe it, but you know, I'm hopeful that because of this, because of all these podcasts, because of all this awareness, that I think it's going to keep continuing. And you know, we've got well, I probably shouldn't bring this up. I was going to mention that guy from Blink 182, Tom DeLonge.
I was going to mention him too, so it's all right.
has he ever come up with his big reveal that he's been promising?
No, not that I know of. But where I was going to mention him was in the sense that, like, I see where you're going with your line of thought. But what concerns me is like people respected J. Allen Hynek. Yeah. He was, you know, the head of an astronomy department at a major university, and Stan Friedman's a nuclear physicist. It's like, this is like the lineage that brought us Trump. This is like we're going to go from the head of an astronomy department, the nuclear physicist, to the lead singer of Blink 182. It's not a good path, point. My friend.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And here's something kind of sad along these lines. So when Kufos was at its, you know, at its high point in the 70s and 80s, they had a lot of really, really amazing people working for them, all volunteer, well, mostly volunteers. And when I started researching the book, as I mentioned, Mark Rodiger, who is now the scientific director of Kufos, you know, I did the book with his blessing and his encouragement, and Mark was an incredible resource to me. And when I first started out researching this, Mark gave me a long list of people who had most of whom had been associated with Kufos at one time or another, who he thought would make good interviews for the book. Now, so I started going down that list and contacting people. I got a hold of some of them. I didn't get a hold of others. The ones I did get a hold of, some of them were willing to do interviews, some of them were not, which kind of surprised me, but, you know, to each his own. But some of the one of the most frustrating situations was there was a gentleman named Alan Hendry who had been, for a time, he was Kufos's one paid UFO investigator.
Yeah.
And he did some really, really interesting and, I think, milestone work in ufology. And the guy's still around, but he retired from ufology several years ago and has become kind of a UFO hermit. And I could never track the guy down, and it became a huge frustration for me, because I would have people mentioning, you know, commenting on my blog and saying, hey, have you gotten a hold of Alan Hendry yet? And I would have to say, well, no, I keep coming up on dead end. So, you know, but my point is, there are some people who are still associated with that golden age. They're still around, but they don't always want to talk about it. And I'm not sure why. It's kind of disappointing.
Well, did
but
you
there's
get
also,
oh, God.
Oh, I was going to say there's also a group, another one of these old Kufos officers, Michael Swords, who's a history professor in Michigan. Michael Swords hosts these annual gatherings of, I affectionately call them the Council of Elders. They are a bunch of UFO reporters, a lot of who were associated with Kufos back in the day, who still get together once or twice a year in Kalamazoo, Michigan, just to talk about their favorite UFO cases. And they're still doing research. They're still coming up with ideas for new ways to look at the data that they have in their files and to, you know, and to come up with some new ideas for how to approach the data. I don't know if you know the book UFOs and Government, that gigantic, indispensable book about how our government and other governments have approached the UFO problem.
I believe so,
That book came about from that group of people. So,
oh, wow. And, so it's kind of like an invisible college in a way.
It kind of is. It kind of is. The Invisible College of Kalamazoo. And they're really great people. I've been to their gatherings, I think, twice now and really enjoyed myself. And Michael is just an amazing UFO resource.
What I was going to ask you is, did you get a chance to talk to Jacques Vallée for the book?
That's an interesting story. I'm glad you asked. So he was another one of these people who was very, very difficult to track down, and I kept coming upon dead end after dead end after dead end. Finally, one of the guys from Michael Swords' group, who I was just talking about, came through with an email for Jacques, and so I sent a letter to Jacques. And this was just in the last few months before I had to turn my manuscript in, so I was really getting down to the wire. But I emailed Jacques, told him about the book, asked if he'd be willing to talk. And to my great surprise, I heard back from him almost immediately, and he said I'm going to pass on doing an interview because, he said, I'm afraid my memories would be faulty, so I don't want you relying on my memory. But he said, you know, I've written a lot about the subject. I've published my personal journals. You have my permission to use any of that material in your book that you'd like.
Oh,
with
that's
my
great.
Blessing. So that was awesome. Awesome just to have him, you know, give me that, you know, be that generous to share his work with me. I was really disappointed that he didn't want to talk to me because, you know, who better?
Right,
who better?
That's why I asked.
To talk about Hynek, his, you know, his life, well, not lifelong, but his decades-long friend and colleague and confidant. So, long story short, I wasn't able to interview Dr. Vallee, but he did contact me about 2 months ago and said, Mark, I've been out of the country, but I've been anxiously awaiting your book. Could you send me a copy? So I sent him a copy, and he's given me some really, really positive feedback. He doesn't agree exactly with everything I have to say in the book, but then again, you know, he could have done an interview, and then he could have corrected those things. So,
because I read the books, now I'm at the risk. I know you can just say I'm not going to tell you, but I have to ask. What didn't he agree with? I'm kind of like stumped about. My mind's racing, trying to figure out what he would have disagreed with.
Well, I guess it's
incompetence.
I guess it's okay to talk about it.
Oh.
No, there were a couple of things, but the one really important thing was, and I knew he would react this way if he ever read the book, it was pretty much a given, was for a long, long time, many, many people have assumed that the character of the French ufologist in the movie Close Encounters was based on Jacques Vallee.
I was going to ask you this, yeah.
Yeah, I had always thought that.
Me too, until I read the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's conventional wisdom. Right. Nobody ever questions it. So, you know, and I was, like I said, as far as I knew, that was the true story, and that was that. Well, when I was writing the chapter of the book that dealt with the movie, it just so happens that because I'm a lifelong science fiction geek, I still have bins and bins of old science fiction fan magazines from the 70s. And when I started writing about the movie in the book, I thought, oh, I should dig out those old magazines. They'll have some good material in them. And one of the magazines, it's called Science. Oh, gosh, I can't remember the name of the magazine. I can go get it in a minute. But
it's all right.
But at any rate, so this one magazine had a huge special issue about Close Encounters, and they interviewed Dr. Hynek, and at one point the reporter says, asks him, you know, if any true life people are represented in the movie, if the French character, for instance, represents a real person. And Hynek says, oh, yes, Claude Poher. He represents the scientific approach to the UFO phenomenon. And my jaw hit the floor.
Yeah, Claude Poher, too. When I was reading the book, I was like, what?
I was shocked. And the thing is, I had already come across Claude Poher's name several times in the narrative because he and Hynek had crossed paths a couple of times. Poher was a French astronomer who, for a time, actually led the French government, much wiser than our government, the French government actually formed an official scientific UFO study project.
JPAN.
JPAN. And Claude Poher had been the first head of that organization. So he was a pretty big wheel in the UFO world. He didn't stick with it very long for reasons I don't understand. But Hynek identified Poher as the model for the Lacombe character. So Jacques Vallee was not pleased with that. And he said, well, I have an article that shows that, in fact, Lacombe was based on me. So we had a testy exchange of emails for about two weeks in July, and we just kind of left it as
agree
well. We'll just have to agree to disagree. Yeah, basically.
Oh my
God! I'm not going to change my. And here's the thing: I also came across after I had submitted my book to the publisher, so I couldn't include this. I came across a book that actually validated my version of events with the Claude Poher identification, and that is there's a really wonderful book about the making of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Came out in 2007. The author, his first name is Ray, and of course I'm blanking on his last name, but it's a really, really good book, and in that book he confirms that the Lacombe character is based on Claude Poher. So I felt vindicated, and I didn't feel like I had to change my story because of Dr. Vallee's complaint.
Wow,
so.
That's a great story. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, you know, I
can tell
it's
a human nature.
That's just exactly.
Human, yeah. It's like, no, bro. All right. That iconic character in the movie is based on me. Shut up. Take that out of your
head. You know,
yeah.
I part of me hated to put that in the book, but the author part of me thought, hey, this is a bombshell. I have to put this in the book. This is so cool.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
it really
so of
was.
Course it went in the book.
Yeah, that's why I reacted so much when you went to that part, because that was a bombshell to me when I was reading it. I was like, I have it right here, page 320, Truffaut's character.
Yeah, well, look for that book on the making of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and you will find independent verification.
Well, it's too bad that he wouldn't do the interview. I interviewed him once a long time ago, and behind it came up briefly. I forget what about. I think it was about whether the government was like reading their correspondence, and I'll try and take out that little clip and send it to you next time I get a chance.
Well, you know, even though we had that little disagreement over some of the content of the book, he was very, very complimentary of the book, which I really appreciated. Another person who I just want to mention, Jenny Zeidman, who is in the book a lot. Really, really interesting person. She was another person who turned me down for an interview. In fact,
really?
Yeah. Okay. So just for your listeners, I'll just give a quick little background.
Yeah, yeah.
Jenny Zeidman was, she took an astronomy course at Ohio State taught by Dr. Hynek in the 40s, distinguished herself as being exceptionally bright, and became Hynek's office assistant and then eventually co-UFO investigator. This woman at age, I think she was something like 22 years old, she got top secret clearance from the Air Force to work on Blue Book research, thanks to Dr. Hynek. And they were lifelong friends
right.
and confidants. And so she was one of the first people I contacted. I got her on the phone. This is all the way back to like 2013, probably, when I was really first starting to do the research. Got her on the phone, told her about the book, asked if she would do an interview. And she said, I've written all about my experience of those times. You're free to use any of that work. And then she hung up on me.
That's the same reaction that Jock had.
And I was stunned.
Yeah.
I was like, you can't hang up on me. Wait a minute. But, you know, and of course I was tempted to call back, but of course I didn't.
Right,
she
right.
had spoken. I had to respect her final decision. But I'm happy to say, so a week or two after the book came out this summer, I got a message on Facebook from somebody I didn't know saying, hey, I am Jenny Zeidman's grandson. She would like to send you a message about your book. Can you give me your email address? So I thought, well, okay, this is a risk, but it's a risk worth taking. So I gave the guy my email address. And a couple of weeks later, I got an email from Jenny. And I'll be honest, I was a little nervous about opening this email.
Right,
I was afraid.
Can imagine, yeah.
Because of her hanging up on me, I was afraid she was going to read me the Riot Act or something. Well, I open her letter, and she just starts right out and says, Dear Mark, you have written Alan exactly as I remember him.
Oh, that's great.
And I was just so flattered. And then about 2 weeks later, she sent me another email, and she said, Mark, I just read the book for the second time, and for the second time, I ended up in tears.
Hmm.
So those are the two best reviews I've gotten. They're the two reviews that mean the most to me.
Yeah, for sure.
For the book. That was just amazing, amazing feedback to get. And in a weird little twist, shortly after that, I got another email from Jacques Vallée, and he said, Hey, Mark, you know what's weird? In all these years, I've never actually met Jenny Zeidman. Could you put me in touch with her?
Oh, wow.
So I put the two of them in touch with each other a couple of weeks ago. I haven't heard yet if they've become best friends. I hope they have. I'll have to follow up on that one of these days.
I'm sure in the first email he was like, can you believe he said that thing about the French guy? That he wasn't
You're
me?
Right. You're right.
You remember Jenny, don't you? You remember? Oh, my God. Yeah, that's weird. It makes you wonder, though, in a sense, where it's like these people probably – he sounded like such a dynamic individual that it's like they cherish their memories. And at the same time,
yeah.
I can imagine being weary about, like, just the whole
–
who are you and why are you writing about my friend who I loved?
Yeah.
And in this field especially, it's not like – even if it was like a rock musician or something, a celebrity or something like that in a sense, it's like people would still be guarded. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so I can
right.
kind of understand that.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting was, as I mentioned at the outset, Mark Rodiger, you give me all these names of people to contact. And I sort of assumed going into this that if I mentioned that I was writing this book with the permission of Kufos, that would just open doors and everybody would want to talk to me. Well, that turned out not to be the case. In some cases, when I mentioned Kufos, people would say, oh, no, thanks. I don't want to do an interview for that book. And I realized that associating myself with Kufos was, in some cases, it was a huge advantage, and in some cases, apparently, it was a liability, which, you know, and I don't think that's peculiar to Kufos. I think that probably would have happened if I had said, you know, I'm doing this book with the blessing of MUFON or with the blessing
of
NICAP or AFRO, you know, APRO. Anybody would have, you know, I always would have run across that, oh, I don't want to have anything to do with them because, you know, there's so much of that in ufology. So that was kind of an interesting lesson I learned early on.
Well, it's interesting. At the end of the book, you could almost look at it from a historical perspective and, I guess, sociological perspective, is when Hynek moves to Arizona, it almost could be titled like Hynek meets ufology. It was like that was his – it seemed like he finally got – The crappy part of the field, like, got a hold of him in a sense, convinced him to move to Arizona, promised him all this money, you know, and then just kind of disrupted his whole life. It was kind of heartbreaking for me having, you know, over the course of the book where it was like, dude, don't go.
You're
not getting $2 million from some French astronomer guy or whatever, or actor or something, to open a giant UFO center. Like, you're getting sucked into ufology. This is the birth of ufology here, man.
Yeah, it is a sad chapter, but that was another case where along the lines of the Sagan and Hynek story where I was nearing my deadline and I didn't know how that story would end. Same thing happened with the Arizona story because so much of that story hinges on this couple, Tina Choate and Brian Myers, who convinced Hynek to move him and his wife down to Arizona and to start up this UFO, this mythical UFO research center. Brian and Tina have been UFO bad guys for like 30 years.
Oh, wow.
In part because of this whole episode with Dr. Hynek, but also in part because there are some case files that belonged, and I'm going to get this wrong now. I can't.
Oh no, are they the ones who own the APRO files?
Yes, that's it exactly.
Well, they are bad guys.
So they were associated with the disappearance of those files. They have not spoken to anybody about any of this for 30 years, and whenever I talked to Mark Rodiger about it, he would just shake his head and say, "Forget it. They're never going to talk to you. They won't talk to anybody." Well, with about a month left before my publisher's deadline, I tracked him down.
Nice.
I can't tell you how I tracked him down because
would
violate their privacy, but I tracked him down, got him on the phone, and they were willing to talk for the first time in 30 years. They were willing to talk about this. It took a while. We actually had about, I think, 3 phone calls, average about an hour long each phone call, before they felt comfortable enough to actually talk on the record. So I really had to do some work to get this interview. But then we had that, you know, then we talked for that last time when they were willing to go on the record, and they shared a whole lot with me. Now, they have, I don't think it really comes through in the book, but they had their own story that they wanted to tell, which didn't always match up with the story that I was trying to tell.
Yeah, yeah.
So because of that, about 90% of our interview wasn't really anything I could use. Not that there was no value in what they told me. They told me a lot of interesting stories. They just didn't fit into what I wanted to do with the book, so I couldn't use any of it. But that, you know, that remaining 10% that actually was relevant was solid gold, so I was able to actually, you know, finish that story, the Arizona story, and, you know, put some sort of a cap on it, some sort of finish on it as far as Brian and Tina were concerned. So I was very happy with that. And, you know, and even at the end, they were like, well, they said, we're really nervous about doing this interview. Would you be willing to send us the chapter, you know, when you have it written up? Would you give us, you know, editorial approval? And I said, no.
Yeah, good.
And they said, well, okay, we'll talk to you anyway. So that was kind of amazing. You know, these two had a lot of reasons for not wanting to talk to me, and I'm very, very grateful for them for, you know, dropping their guard. And I just told them, I said, look, I'll be fair with you. I'll treat you fairly. That's all I can promise. And they said,
exactly.
Okay, we trust you on that. And I'd like to think I succeeded.
Yeah, I mean, you were just telling a story here. I mean, you're not.
Yeah.
Yeah, those Aprophiles are like the Alexandria Library of Ufology.
Yeah.
They've been missing for a long, long time.
Well, and you know what? I never even asked them about it because I just thought they'll probably clam up and not talk to me anymore.
Yeah, then they would get all pissed off,
So
it's
no,
weird,
no
though. As soon as you asked, as soon as you mentioned, I know how it is as an interviewer, As soon as you mentioned, like, missing files, I was like, that's got to be the APRO files,
Yep, yeah, that's definitely it.
Yeah. Man, I really enjoyed the book a lot. I really loved it a lot. And you were talking about his friend there, and I got to say, man, when I got to the end of that book, I got choked up myself. I got really sad. Obviously, spoiler alert, Jay Allen Hynek passes away at the end of the book. It was sad in a lot of ways. It was really, I loved how you tied the whole thing in through with Halley's Comet. It was awesome.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I thought that was interesting. So he was born in 1910 when Halley's Comet was in the sky, and he passed away in 1986 when Halley's Comet came back, just like Mark Twain before him.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And the whole book, too, I was like, because I didn't really know when he passed away. So I was kind of, it would come up every now and again, and I'm like, oh, God, I hope he makes it to Halley's Comet at the end. So at the end, when you write the movie of this book, that should be, like I said, you can tell you're a screenwriter because you kind of like bookended the life.
Oh,
the universe bookended it for him.
Oh, yeah, I know. I just, it wasn't too hard to work with what I had, really.
Yeah.
You know who's my hero in the book? I just want to put in a plug for this guy. Is William Powers, who comes up when Dr. Hynek was teaching at Northwestern.
Okay,
Bill Powers worked for Dr. Hynek for several years and was basically his right-hand man, often when it came to his Project Blue Book investigations. Bill was just kind of a hero to me. He was another one of these people who people told me I would never track him down, and I tracked him down, and we spent several hours talking on Skype. He always wanted to talk on Skype because he wanted there to be visual contact. And he was, he was a very old man. He was clearly in very frail, fragile health, but he was so much fun to talk to. He was so funny, and he was so gracious and so thoughtful, and I just loved the guy, and I fit in as many Bill Powers stories as I possibly could in the book, probably more than I should have, but I just thought, this guy is so cool. His thinking needs to be preserved, so I kept putting him in the book every chance I got, and I thought, well, if my editor makes me cut it, I'll cut it, but he never did, so all the Bill Powers stuff remains, and the guy was truly entertaining.
Yeah, he was a cool character in the book. There was at least a lot to think about, when there's a part of me that when the book ends, it ends, obviously he passed away like in the mid-80s, mm-hmm. just things haven't been the same since, man, and I don't know, it just makes me very sad because no one's considering this. I guess here's a question for you, because he was advocating for this scientific look at this. Do you think just like we lost him and then there was no one? Because it seems like this, it jumped immediately to the ETH. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it was like it seemed
absolutely.
Like once he was gone, there was no one advocating just for an honest look at this. Then it became a loaded deal on the UFO side where it was like, they're aliens, man.
Uh-huh. Well, there's one major factor here that I didn't discuss it in the book because I didn't think it was really germane to the story I wanted to tell. But there is a big chapter in this story that I think doesn't get talked about, and that is that after Dr. Hynek moved to Arizona, in 84, he was still associated with KUFOS back up in Chicago, but he wasn't actively involved. So basically, he had a lot of young, energetic, excited guys up in Chicago running KUFOS, and as Michael Sores is quoted in my book, he's saying they really were in need of adult supervision.
Yeah.
And it was right about this time that people started getting enamored with the Roswell story.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of happened that – so after Dr. Hynek passes away, KUFOS goes through this period of sort of trying to figure out what their mission is now. What are they supposed to be about now that their guiding light is gone?
Right, right.
And there really is no natural successor to take Hynek's place. What are they going to do? Well, for various reasons, Kufos got involved in this search for proof of the Roswell saucer crash and poured a lot of resources, a lot of human resources, a lot of money into trying to make a big thing about the Roswell case. And in my opinion, that was a tragic mistake because I am not a fan of the Roswell story. I think if there was anything that could be proven, we would know it by now. I think it has just been such a huge black hole for the study of UFOs.
It's been a bit of a boondoggle.
It has, but unfortunately, that has become the face of UFOs to the vast majority of the public.
Right.
And part of that is because these guys at Kufos just kind of went Roswell crazy in the late 80s. You know, they started doing archaeological digs, and they started, you know, finding all the smoking guns that all fizzled. And it's really sad. And I think if Hynek knew that was what Kufos ended up being about, they're not about that now. They have sort of come back to reality, I'm happy to say. But
do they exist still now? I mean, what's the status?
Well, they do. Mark Rodiger is still active, and I mentioned his colleague Mary Kastner, Mary has a whole bunch of Kufos' case files in her basement, and I know Mary's been writing a book for a few years. I think I can probably talk. I won't give a whole lot of details, but she's been working on a book about the Heflin photographs.
Yeah.
Analyzing the Heflin photographs. Mark Rodiger is, he's done a lot of work on Close Encounters of the Second Kind. He's especially interested in cases that involve UFOs having an effect on motor vehicles, shutting off engines and headlights. That's kind of his specialty. So he still does study in that field, at least, probably others. And he consults on a lot of other things. I know he does some work with Leslie Keen, who wrote the wonderful UFOs, Pilots, Generals, and Politicians. I know I'm getting that subtitle wrong. But so I know Mark still does a lot of work here and there with people who want his expertise. Mark also does some of the expert on-camera interviews for the Canadian series Close Encounters.
Okay.
Which is one of the better UFO shows, in my opinion. So.
Well,
so yeah, they're still around and they're still active. They're not. What's that?
It says a low barrier to cross.
Well, that's true. So yeah, they're still around. They're still active, but there's just no funding.
Right, right.
Yeah, there's no money at all. So there's just not much going on.
Well, there's just not the excitement around this topic anymore. There was in the book. That's the real. Like I said, that fear of missing out, that fear of having missed out. That I experienced reading the book, it was like, oh my God, people took this seriously. Like, what a time to be alive. I wish I had been there back in the day. You know, has there been any? I know obviously the book just came out a few months ago, but given your background and everything, is there any chance this could be a movie? Because I think it's awesome.
Well, it's funny you ask that. There is right around the time the book came out, an announcement came out. From the History Channel, that they had just bought a series called tentatively titled Blue Book, that's all about Project Blue Book and the work of J. Allen Hynek. Now, this is completely separate from my book. The producers of that show have contacted me, and it's possible that could lead to me being involved in that show, but it's way too early to say. So, so there is that project. I am actually also, we're involved in, shopping the film rights to my book, of course.
Yeah.
And I'm also actually developing a pitch for a TV series based on one tiny little part of the book that I can't identify. But it's, to me, it's a really interesting and fun chapter in the UFO story. I'm developing as a TV series pitch. So if I'm lucky, I'll have a chance to maybe pitch that around to studios later this year.
Yeah. All right, interesting. Poe, you always talk about this on every show, but I'll try and cut to the, I'll give like a summary, and then you can kind of like flesh it out a little bit if you want.
Okay.
That was the swamp gas thing.
Of course, I knew you'd ask.
I put it down to the very end, dude.
I put it down to
the very end because I know that's like the thing that everybody probably asks about. And like I said, I'll give a thumbnail, like from what I picked up on this, because the idea is that everyone always thinks that Hynek went there and immediately dismissed the swamp gas, dismissed the UFO sighting as swamp gas, and everybody hated him, and he was just lying. That was the idea. He was lying to make up this excuse for the Air Force.
Right.
And what you elucidate in the book, and I don't know if anyone's ever done as thorough an examination of this case, of this incident, let's say, the swamp gas incident, than you did. So I was really, really impressed by the depth with which you dug into this. But it, you know, what people don't know, I'm sure, or realize, is that when he got there, like 6 or 7 people were like, yeah, it seemed like swamp gas.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That was like, what? This guy's off the hook, man. Like, give me a break.
Yeah,
so,
totally.
And I want talk a little bit about this part of the story because it really stood out to me. Because you speculate in the book about what may have happened here, was that the day of the swamp gas press conference, there was a newspaper article, mysterious newspaper article, that said the Air Force is going to have a press conference and say it's swamp gas. And, like, no one's quite sure where it came from, and you speculate that maybe it was planted by Blue Book.
I'm totally convinced. I have no proof of it, but I'm totally convinced that that article was written by Hector Quintanilla, or at least, you know, at least directed by Hector Quintanilla, who was at the time, 1966, the project chief of Project Blue Book. And most people, I think, would agree that Quintanilla was the worst project chief that Blue Book ever had. He was outright hostile towards the UFO phenomenon. He was hostile towards Dr. Hynek. He hated all of it. But yeah, the swamp gas case comes along, and it's multiple sightings going on over the course of several nights. So it's really a mass UFO sightings, which of course always gather a lot of attention. So it becomes national news. Blue Book at first does not want to send Hynek to Michigan to investigate, but they kind of have to change their tune and they send him to Michigan because they're under so much pressure from the Pentagon to make this story go away. So Hynek spends 3 days in southern Michigan interviewing all these witnesses and visiting the scenes of the sightings, and nothing really adds up to Hynek. You know, he's hearing there's a certain consistency. People saw floating lights. This farm family saw floating lights down in the swamp behind their house.
Can I jump in one moment? I just want to make one point that was stunning to me in the book. And I'm not sure if you're going to mention it because you said he interviewed a bunch of witnesses. But, folks, there was a girls' dormitory that saw the UFO. There were 75 girls that saw this UFO. And he was allowed to interview 2.
Yeah.
2 of the girls. So when people get on his case about saying it was swamp gas, it's like, can you imagine, you know, give me a break, man. There were 75 witnesses, and he was only allowed to interview 2.
And they weren't the 2 primary witnesses either. They were witnesses who didn't look out their windows till later.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing is, it's almost criminal, but you can understand because the dorm house mother was so protective of her students. And it was obvious that this was such a sensational situation. It was in the media everywhere. The dorm house mother, she was just feeling protective.
Oh, yeah, for
of her
sure.
Students,
he was
she
a
only
victim of
Hynek talked to 2 of them.
Yeah,
but, yeah, it is crazy. But again, that's one of the things that adds to Hynek's frustration with the case. He didn't have access to all the witnesses. Even the farm family, who should have been Frank Manor and his son, who were 2 of the prime witnesses, he could barely talk to them. Because by the time he showed up at their farm was overrun with policemen and news reporters and sightseers who all wanted to talk to these people. So Hynek had to, like, take a number to talk to the prime witnesses. The whole thing was a complete fiasco. And the whole time, Hynek is under pressure from his boss, Quintanilla, to come up with a natural, quote unquote explanation. In other words, do not say it was flying saw. Do not say it was spaceships. You know, come up with a natural explanation. Well, yeah, as you mentioned, and I'm gonna put more of this on my blog because it's a pretty interesting story. This was a big chunk that had to be cut out of the book because it got so long. But yeah, during the course of those 3 days, there are between like 6 and 8 different people who apparently suggested to Hynek that they were dealing with swamp gas.
Right.
This includes one of the prime witnesses, the county civil defense agent, who was called to the college dorm and was watching these lights in the arboretum along with the college students. He said that he told Hynek, when I first saw it, I thought it was swamp gas. So this, you know, this idea that Hynek came up with the swamp gas idea, you know, out of his, you know what, and, you know, and threw that out at the press conference out of desperation just to, you know, cover for the Air Force. It's totally not true. Hynek was being told all week, I think it's swamp gas. I think it's swamp gas. You should look at the swamp gas theory. So it's pretty interesting how that whole thing turned out. But here's the really crazy twist of it. As mad as people were at Hynek for the swamp gas explanation, because, of course, everybody back at Evanston, Dr. Vallée, all of Hynek's Invisible College cohorts, you know, all of his allies in the UFO research world were all expecting Hynek to say, this is the big one. You know, this is the case that proves
that
we are being visited from other worlds. And they were all pissed at him because he didn't say that, because he said it was swamp gas. So he's got people on both sides furious with him. The Air Force is furious because, you know, just because. because Hynek let things get out of hand. And Hynek's UFO colleagues are pissed at him because they think he told a lie to cover for the Air Force. So, you know, Hynek beat it out of town because everybody in Michigan hated him. He was being lampooned in newspaper editorial cartoons all over the country, which he started a collection of, by the way. I never saw this, but at the time in 1966, Hynek kept a folder or a three-ring binder where he preserved all of these cartoons making fun of him. So he leaves town right away. But I'm telling you, I'm looking through his correspondence files at the Northwestern University Archives from this period of time, spring 1966, going into summer and fall 1966, and you would not believe the amount of letters Hynek got from people all over the world in the wake of the swamp gas case.
Yeah.
Instead of ruining his career, the swamp gas case made him an international celebrity, and he was the go-to UFO expert from that moment on. And these letters are just amazing. He's got just dozens and dozens of letters, and all they're really long letters from people saying, I want to tell you about my experience.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, Hynek just became the man, period. And there was never anybody else to rival him from that point forward.
Yeah, yeah. I can imagine on a small scale where it's like, I don't know if you, I'm sure you've run into this, just telling people what you write about and what you've written about, you know, where people are like, let me tell you about what happened to me, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, and that's, I'm glad you brought that up.
It's
I'm
the committee
so
complex that Hynek would talk about.
Right, it is. It is so amazing, and this is borne out for me so many times in social situations where sometimes it's because I'm talking about my book, but not always. But people will hear me mention UFOs in a serious way, like mention UFOs without making fun of them. And it is amazing how often people will sort of bend their ear to hear what I'm talking about. And they'll come over and say, hey, you know, I saw something once. And then before I know it, I'm hearing this UFO report from somebody who has never told a soul about this ever in their life.
Mm-hmm.
It happens to me all the time. And I like to tell people, just bring up UFOs casually in conversation in a group of people. And you would be amazed how many people will say, you know, I saw something once. As long as the topic is brought up in the right way, where people don't feel threatened, and feel that, you know, and feel secure that they won't be ridiculed, they'll start opening up about their experience. It's amazing.
Yeah. It really makes you wonder if there was like something that happened, you know, in the interim, when because people were all excited and talking about this, and now it's like, yeah. It's crazy because people. I feel that like nowadays people genuinely believe in UFOs, but they don't really care to do anything about it. That's like that's like the weird part. You know what I mean? It's like,
Well, they do something about it. I'm going to contradict you there because. Part of my preparation for writing this book and for writing my blog was that I became a MUFON field investigator for several years, because I really wanted to talk face to face with UFO witnesses and find out what the experience was like and find out how it affected them and find out, you know, what made them decide to report it. And here's what they do. You were saying they don't do anything, and I'm sure the vast majority of people don't. But there
That's
are
what
a
I
lot
mean.
Of people.
Yeah,
there are a lot of people who. Because of what they see on cable TV, they're aware of MUFON, and so they'll report their case to MUFON. So MUFON gets thousands and thousands of case reports. The vast majority of them are pretty useless. You know, there's insufficient data, or it's pretty clear that the so-called witness is pulling your leg, they're making stuff up. But there are, every once in a while, there is a really, I have a list of absolutely crazy sightings that I investigated that I can't explain, and they're some of my favorite stories. But so at any rate, I'm making a short story long, but people, a lot of people will report to MUFON, and their motivations I found are really interesting. They don't necessarily want you to come out and interview them. They just say, well, I just wanted to put it out there and see if anybody else has seen the same thing.
Yeah.
The other big reason is, well, I want somebody to explain to me what I saw. Those are like the two big reasons. Somebody please explain to me what I saw, and please tell me if anybody else has ever seen the same thing, because that helps them get a grip on their experience.
Yeah. Yeah, what I was saying is like people just don't, the average person, you know what I'm saying? The mainstream does not even give it a second thought. But at the same time, it's like a trick in a sense, like that Kaiser Soze thing, where it's like they believe UFOs are real, but they just don't give it a second thought.
Yeah,
it's a very weird state of society, I guess you'd say.
I think that's a fair point. Yeah,
you know, it's frustrating in a sense where it's like they've given up. They've given up on the idea that the government will tell. The government knows, and they won't tell us. Period. The end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you did a general poll on people, I think that would be like, it was like, do you believe in UFOs, but that the government won't tell you, I think would be like the, would win overwhelmingly.
Probably.
So, whether that's the case or not, I don't know, because in the book you say Hynek said, his estimation was that it was more a case of ignorance rather than trying to conceal the truth.
Yeah, that was his gut feeling.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, if they can't figure it out, the last thing they want people to know is that they can't figure it out. So
yes, exactly. They are going to cover that up like crazy.
Right, right. The cover-up is they don't – is that they had, like, a world-class astronomer from Northwestern who was trying to figure it out, and they couldn't figure it out. So
yeah, you want to hear a weird, weird story? This is something that –
Sure.
I think –
You're on the right show for that.
This was something that I left out of the book because I didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
We talked before about the Washington, D.C. merry-go-round, that case in the early 50s where the sky above Washington, D.C. was just filled with flying saucers for two weekends in a row, and that Edward Ruppelt was kept away from investigating the case. Ruppelt tells in his book, which is a very, very good book, by the way, he tells a story of how shortly before that Washington, D.C. mass sighting, he was having a talk with somebody who works for a government agency that cannot be identified, and this person told him, allegedly, that his agency had been tracking UFO sightings, and they had seen some consistent patterns, and that they had predicted that there was about to be a major sighting above a major American city, probably New York City or Washington, D.C.
Wow.
Now, there's no way to verify this story.
Yeah.
You know, Ruppelt is long gone. He can't tell us, he can't tell us where he heard this story. There's no way to trace it. But isn't that a tantalizing story, though? Because if that's true, why didn't they keep using that trick to predict UFO sightings? It's an intriguing and tantalizing story, but then you think about it in a second and it's like, that can't possibly be true. It makes no sense.
Yeah, it's weird. That's weird. Yeah.
Just another one of those bizarre mysteries in UFO world that I don't know if it can ever be explained.
Yeah, it's like, how do they, yeah. Yeah. Well, I will say, though, I've said on the show before, now, you know, looking back on, not necessarily these cases from the Hynek book, but I think that somebody, please, listeners, needs to, like, do a look back at this thing with the drones. I think the drones can explain a lot of UFO sightings, a lot. I mean, this is, you know, I don't know how far back you can go, but, like, we need to start looking at it going, could it have been a drone? Based on what we know now about these drones, could it have been a drone? You know?
Yeah.
But we're at the end of the show, Mark, so I'm going to let
you
go. Because I know I've. Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this, man. I really appreciate it. I absolutely love the book. You know that.
Thank you.
Thought it was amazing.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me on the show. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Well, I hope you had fun, man. I tried to bring as much as obscure stuff as I could to the table and cite some of the more obscure stuff that I thought was relevant to today's ufology too, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
You know, so I really appreciate it, and you're one of the good guys, man.
I hope
this book gets into the hands of people that need to read it. You know what I'm saying? Like the astronomers and people like that. It's like we need more. We need somebody who's as brave as J. Allen Hynek to step forward from a major university and go, let's investigate this stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
oh, hey, they're aliens. You know, that's the thing.
Yeah.
It's the old Sagan trick. They get caught up in this mess. And if they say, hey, let's look at UFOs, it's like, oh, you believe in little green men. We need someone who's brave and strong enough to stand up and say, no, I just think that this thing has persisted for decades, and let's get to the bottom of it once and for all.
I couldn't agree with you more.
So let's hope that happens. We need a new J. Allen Hynek, but until then, we can celebrate the original. So thank you so much for being on the show. Folks,
you're welcome.
The book is The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. Outstanding stuff from Mark O'Connell. Thank you very much, sir. Good night.
Thanks. Good night.
All right, folks, there you go. That was Mark O'Connell talking about The Close Encounters Man. Fantastic stuff. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I really did. Yeah, I can't put the book over enough. I left out so much stuff in that interview. There were so many elements to J. Allen Hynek's life, especially the astronomy part we didn't really get into, except for the Sputnik story. And just his whole evolution as a ufologist is fascinating, fascinating stuff. He wasn't even a ufologist, man. He was like a pre-ufologist, which is even better. And on that note, I don't know what else I have to say. It's been a while since we did the show. I'm back from Canada. You should have listened to the Good Parade last week to get the Canada recap. Next week on the program, I cannot tell you who the guest will be. I've got a couple of folks lined up. We're going to go through a little run here of first-time guests here on the final season. So stay tuned for that. And I presume we'll have the usual show next week, Tuesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. So until that time, thank you, my friends, for listening. This is Tim Banal, signing off.